Checking back in with State Representative Techie Chan of Quincy for a Thursday edition of Techie Talk. How's it going, Techie?
Good morning, Joe. Yeah, it's Thursday morning on the 25th of July, and it's about 10:05 with a bit of cloudy weather.
And you are in your State House office today.
We are. As opposed to trying to be at home for a morning with you and then drive right to office afterwards, today I actually have morning in-person stuff. So it became a bit of a need to get to you, the office just to get on camera with you, Joe. And
Wow,
then
I am honored and a little disturbed by that. But I'm glad you did it.
Yeah, today we have a formal session I'm not exactly sure what's happening yet. The calendar's in flux, but we'll know in about an hour or so. And we have some students, Otaka's students from Japan visiting, hosted by Representative Manny Cruz and Senator Lovely, that do a quick meet and greet and say hello. And even though we're in the closing end of session, we still get visitors, as you hear, from around the country, but also locally. We had the Quincy Swell students, the English language learner students from Quincy Public Schools, do a tour yesterday. Me and Senator Keenan, greeted them at the State House yesterday. So, even though a lot of folks think that we're just sitting here in public policy, when students from home or students from abroad make a visit, it's very good courtesy, even if it's a short hello, to at least say hello.
And a week from today actually is the first day of August. So yeah, you have 1 week to get things done.
That is absolutely true. And things are moving along, as you see in the press. We did finally send to the governor the budget with a little bit of time to spare last Friday. We had a session last Friday to do that. And we'll have enough time to do any veto overrides towards the end of the calendar year for the session. We did well. Cities getting about $60 million in local aid when we consider the Chapter 7 education money plus the unrestricted local aid. Obviously, we were able to fund the libraries and senior center and other important city programs such as school breakfast and school lunches. The city is getting their earmarks, whether it be a not-for-profit agency or directly city, like the Quincy Fire Department has a hazmat program that we help fund. We can provide money to important nonprofits like QCAP, Quincy Resources, Germantown Neighborhood Center. We put some funding in for the Adams Presidential Library. I think the state may be one of the bigger donors at this point to the Adams Presidential Library project. Some funding for Quincy College students regarding financial assistance. It will spread the money around the city in different places. And Senator Keenan obviously has a much larger district, and he has to also accommodate, Braintree, Hanover, Rockland, Abington. So, Senator Keenan actually has to address a wider geographic zone regarding providing some local assistance. We respect that. So the House delegation works closely with the Senate on trying to make sure that all our local interests are accounted for. So we did well then. And the big news coming out of the budget was the iLottery. Internet lottery is coming to Massachusetts. You may be able to play lottery games on your cell phone at some point. The regulations probably take a bit of time to put together. And that money has been earmarked for early education grants. So it's going to help support C3 grants is what they refer to as. But that's the biggest major policy piece that's been coming out of this year's budget. So yeah, it's been really busy. I know we joke, everyone makes fun of me about working on Fridays, but yeah, we were in session on Friday as we're trying to get this under our belts. There's a conference committee on climate change and energy that started work on Monday. Economic Development Bill Conference Committee started work on Monday. We still have several outstanding conference committees going into the final days. But we've got some conference reports that came out on Friday as well. The Information Technology Bond Bill, we voted on that yesterday, the sense of the governor. And we also completed conference committee on wage transparency, which in summary, requires that businesses 25 and older report to the state the salary ranges of different positions, so that people have some idea what the salary ranges for a certain profession are in the state, but also in job postings. I don't know if people notice, but job postings aren't putting salaries in, which makes it very difficult for an applicant to decide what it is. And also can ask lowballing people whether, it doesn't matter who you are, but I mean, obviously, some of the obvious choices that the employer sees the employee, a potential employee, and could take advantage of a potential employee, perhaps a lowball salary against the market rate. So, I had friends and other folks, comment that, they look on the websites that they don't see a salary as part of the job description. The state has to put salaries per job description, no salary range. But private sector does not. So that's really kind of a disadvantage to people trying to find a job because, what is the competitive rate for the profession you're looking for if we don't know?
Yeah. With the online lottery, Tacky, are there safeguards in place to prevent minors from accessing that?
Similar to sports betting, the technology exists to put some safeguards. And I do truly understand, as we learned from the CrowdStrike crash on Friday, which took down a global issue. There are challenges associated with technology. And there's, I know, virtual protocol networks, VPNs, and the gambling apps are keeping up on trying to prevent using out-of-state mechanisms because you only can use the state lottery. Gambling in the state of Massachusetts, just like sports betting, and to set up more and more firewalls and keep up with folks trying to breach those mechanisms on the gambling website and gambling apps to ensure they stay inside state lines and ensure verification of identity. There's no perfect way to do this. I mean, if you've been around long enough, I won't, I'm going to age myself, but you've been around long enough, even from the early days of the lottery. Underage lottery play has always been a challenge. And whether it is a situation where someone buys for somebody else, or you send your teenager to get a pack of cigarettes when that used to be a real thing when I was young. You send your kid out with money for cigarettes and a lotto ticket. So it's the enforcement by the lottery reduces those possibilities because of the risk it has on the store or vendor of the lottery, but also could potentially put your liquor license at risk if you have a liquor license involved, whether it be a restaurant or a retail store. So, again, there's no perfect system, folks. The best we can do is do our best in keeping enforcements and set up mechanisms of greater consequences if you buck the rules.
Right. So it any idea when that would begin?
No, but I suspect probably sometime within 1 year.
Okay. All right. I know that the state treasurer has been pushing, advocating for that for quite a while. Is that where she wanted the funds to be directed?
Well, I don't think she was too concerned what the funds are going to be directed in many ways. I mean, the negotiation between the House and Senate regarding internet lottery has been going on for a good part of a decade. When the Senate's put it in economic development bills in the past, and we put it into the state budget, and they didn't want to put it into the state budget, that means this whole give and take. And in more recent times, the Senate president expressed a strong interest regarding early education funding. We have no mechanism for it. House proposal was to use internet lottery as the mechanism. And that's how this conversation got going between the two leadership branches about what is the options to try to move a priority forward. And we'll see how it plays out. The lottery believes that this mechanism will attract young players in a very competitive marketplace for gambling dollars, because there's a lot of different ways to gamble in Massachusetts now. And not uniquely Massachusetts, the whole country has some variations of sports betting, internet gambling for a lottery and other choices of people want to do. Sports betting is going to start sweeping the country even more, I think. I think more and more legislatures are going to be pushing forward on that around the country.
Yeah, and now that, I mean, brick and mortar casinos too.
Yeah, it's a different experience, right? I mean, part of it is, are you seeking a brick, a experience in the casino, or are you seeking the ability to convenience to play some games on your phone? And
Right.
everyone is different. Obviously, gambling addiction is a huge priority, and we want to ensure that sufficient funding goes into that. And we've been working Department of Public Health from my committee chair to get better data sets from the casinos. in particular through the Mass Gaming Commission, to find out, where we need to put resources properly. You need data sets. Sadly, all data sets run about 1, perhaps 2 years behind, depending on what data sets we're looking for. And it does take some time for these data sets to be compiled and recommend policy recommendations. I can make policy recommendations inside its own agencies and perhaps the legislature.
Yeah, so you had to wait for data on the new millionaire's tax, right, before you could bake that into the budget, I know.
Yeah, we're probably looking at about 3 to 5 years of consistent data. We do understand as economic rise and falls, millionaire's tax is impacted by the change in economy. And people's estates, some of the many things that we do as we grow older, particularly you have some means. When you start looking down a field when you turn into your 50s to your early 60s about how to manage your estate, for yourself, but also, when you move on and leave the state to your family or children, obviously you have a spouse or you have children and you have some means, you want to have mechanisms in place. And that could potentially affect millionaire's tax. It's not. It's again a case by case situation for individuals to decide what's best for themselves and how they decide to move assets around. But a lot of noise is always made, oh, people are fleeing Massachusetts. Well, I'm not disagreeing with the numbers, but New York State, for example, has been chasing people down on pretend residency, meaning that they have a home in Florida to take advantage of the zero income tax Florida state, but they're really maintaining a residence 9 months in New York to pretend to be not home. And this is unfortunately becoming a real thing. States are now realizing that this is what people do. We've always had the New Hampshire problem, right? Where people go to New Hampshire. So obviously, the Department of Revenue is very conscientious of this potential. Are you really here, or are you just pretending to be not here, right? And people listening, like, oh no, people don't do that. Yes, people do that. Okay, if you have enough means, you're gonna do it. So as I like to point out, the fact that home vacancy rates for sale is still extremely low. It's less than 2%. And that means, if you have wealthy people leaving, shouldn't they sell their house? And they're not. And that's what's going on, even because even wealthy areas, there's not a high turnover in homes. And people who wants to avoid taxes tend to be people who have more money. As I'll Republicans are rallying against the IRS regarding enforcement. I just love the fact law and order people think tax evasion is acceptable.
As I always said, I pay my taxes. I want everybody else to pay them too.
Oh, I'm the same way. I mean, you take money my W-2, I do my taxes once a year, I do TurboTax. Thank you. Mine isn't very complicated. But I love listening to congressional Republicans say that it's a burden on middle class families. I'm like, no, middle class families pay their taxes. There may be some folks that have some errors, but the people who have real means, will do the work the hardest to avoid taxes. And they keep talking about downsizing and destroying the IRS. I'm like, really? I mean, over here in the Department of Revenue, in them and other agencies actually generate more money than we put into it, because if they do proper enforcement, they're going to get money back, which actually takes less burden off of you as a proper taxpayer. And that's a big thing. And we all make errors. I've been hit up with a wrong number before and had to pay an extra, like, 10 or 20 bucks, because it's not like I have a lot. But that does happen. But it isn't like people are actively trying to avoid paying taxes at all.
Has there ever been discussion on Beacon Hill, Tacky, about graduated income tax instead of the flat tax that the state has?
Well, that's the millionaire's tax,
Oh,
because
okay.
the flat tax is actually set by state constitution. And the Supreme Judicial Court has established so-called classes of individuals regarding certain types of credits, deductions, and tax, basic credit deductions. I mean, the Supreme Court has never touched flat tax because the Constitution mandates a flat tax.
I see.
So when we did millionaire's tax, we created our first graduated tax under the flat tax scheme. There's been proposals in the past by the public to try to create a graduated tax. Very few people inside this place in my lifetime has suggested a graduated tax. But outside the state house, various advocacy groups have suggested it, and the millionaire's tax is what they landed on, as opposed to doing a more federal income tax.
Yeah.
So
Okay.
remind folks the flat tax in Massachusetts is 5% on passive and active income. We did make some changes regarding long-term and short-term capital gains. It's going to be a gradual reduction over the course of 2 years, which right now I can't remember, but I did remember talking about this last year. So I know it's true. And of course, we've done things like, change the estate tax that you don't get taxed if you get past the first $2 million of your estate for every dollar that's past the first million. We did some consolidation of the parental and help, what do you call it? People who caretake for the parents as well as people with developmental issues, tax credit, and consolidate that into a single tax credit, lifted the cap on that. Same thing with the child care. In terms of, you have kids, we had some caps on that. We took those off as well. So, we did a lot of tax reform last cycle, which kicked in this year's budget, and it turns out it bakes in just fine.
Okay. All right. Speaking of the federal government, big changes since last we talked in the presidential race.
Well, it's been a very busy July. I've never seen this much news. I can't speak to other folks who probably see much more than I have, but I mean, inside of a 2 week period, I mean, we've had a huge, frightening situation regarding an attempted assassination of a presidential candidate. And then we have another presidential candidate who decides to exit the race prior to the convention, the national convention. And, obviously, I wish no harm to anyone. Congress actually, both political parties actually grilled and should grill the chief of the Secret Service Agency, who abruptly resigned this week after the grilling. And both political parties in Congress are initiating probes on how to better secure presidential candidates. It's very troubling that the more news we hear, this should have been preventable. It seems it's a huge failure on Secret Service that this was allowed to actually happen. And a lot of very confusing information that came out as well as the investigation continued by the FBI. And I think there'll be more information as the FBI completes its complete report. And I think there's going to be not just the failures of the Secret Service, but also local law enforcement.
Yeah,
So there's going to be quite a bit of information, I think.
absolutely. And it's going to, I'm sure, manifest itself in huge security increases at the Democratic convention coming
Yeah, I made some jokes about the level of frisking involved as you try
up.
to get magnetron detectors. Obviously, you guys all know I don't have a strong interest to go to the DNC conventions. I just don't on a personal level. It's a lot of people. It's very crowded, very, very high security, and it can be a lot of fun. There's parties, you meet some, important people and things like that. But I mean, this time though is a very historic opportunity with President Biden not running for re-election, and Vice President Kamala Harris working very hard this past weekend to secure all the delegate votes that she needs, and to convince other folks who would be potential candidates not to engage on putting their name onto the floor. It could be a fairly smooth convention, but I'll tell you this: I mean, as a Democrat, I mean, Joe Biden was not exactly making me very excited. As I like to say, the campaign is only as good as the candidate and the candidate's ability to work hard. And I'm not saying Joe Biden couldn't work hard. I think we all agree that there's certain things we can't beat, and one of them is age and time. And clearly, time has caught up with the president, and the ability to maintain running a country and running around the country to run for office is taking its toll. And he served 50 years, folks, and he's a man who was not supposed to get elected. He has a very severe stutter, running in a time period where there's very little sympathy or understanding of folks with speech impediments and the impacts on how a person thinks. And he was never supposed to be a city councilor. He was never supposed to be a U.S. senator. He faced tragedy at a young age with the death of his wife and one of his children, had to make a hard decision whether or not to stay in office or go to the private sector as a widower with young boys. And then proceeded to decide to stay in the Senate and ran for president three times. And the third time was the charm. And He does have foot and mouth disease. For those who are too young, that means you say stuff you probably shouldn't say because times have changed, and you got to remember words change, times that change. But I never once doubt the man's integrity. I never once doubt the man's desire to be a public servant, because when you do 50 years of that, that's a real commitment to the public. We've talked about his job over the course of this podcast, and I'm very thankful for the work he's put in a very difficult situation. And nothing like is perfect. Like I said, there's mistakes to be made, but he does get out there and puts his best foot forward in the interest of the country. So getting out now is not necessarily just the best interest of the Democratic Party. It's also the best interest of the country. He can now focus solely in the last five months of his term of office to run the country, because he doesn't have to run around the country campaigning for himself. And it puts the vice president in a very unique situation where you're actually part of an administration, but you're not the chief decision maker. It is the president who makes all final decisions, not the vice president. She has the ability to essentially campaign full time, as a part of an existing administration. And it also creates a huge pivot for Donald Trump and the Republican Party about how they want to approach the remaining months of this campaign. But I will say this, it is definitely an energy booster for Democrats to see her on the top of the ticket now to give everybody, a new, not new face per se, but I mean, ideas that represent a different generation. I think people kind of forget that. I mean, she's closer to my age. She's an Xer, right? She's Gen X, right? So, we have, it's been a while since Obama, really. And then you had Clinton. Both of them were closer to the generation, new generation of elected, so to speak, right? You have that upcoming elected official that represents a generation that's behind the generation of the current elected until we got to Donald Trump and Joe Biden. We broke that trend of where you have that new generation that's younger than the current elected, and then you kind of move along on the progression of a new ideas because the
Right.
young generation's coming up.
Yeah,
And
that was the big appeal to Kennedy back then, right?
oh, absolutely. I mean, the youngest president elected, I believe.
That's right.
I think Clinton was only a few years, maybe a year older than JFK. I have to look it up. But absolutely. I mean, it was a new generation of ideas and new folks that can relate to. And it's hard to relate to folks that have a mindset of a generation time that's gone by in some ways. And other ways, those values still hold on as well. But you want someone that can talk and you can relate to in politics. And challenge, of course, is can you get the widest audience possible, through your words and through your ideas to show they can relate to this part of the demographic. And
Right.
it's not surprising that Donald Trump picked J.D. Vance, 38 years old. Well, actually, no, 30, turning 40, actually. I think, yeah, he's going to turn 40 soon. So they're trying to reach the millennial generation. And very different set of ideas. Let's put aside some of the comments he made about Donald Trump early on, which were extremely unflattering if you want to look them up. I would not repeat them. But he also represents a whole generation different. He's very clearly shown that he's a generation of the Great Recession of 08, the way he talks. Very much a product of the Great Recession. So we'll see how this plays out as it goes along, but I'm expecting a very, very stimulated DNC convention this year. I think the media coverage will be very strongly focused on her as the media starts to suss out and provide more information. And if you make a graph, graph, like, if you make a mistake saying something, I mean, trust me, it's going to be blown out again in the next 3 or so weeks going to the convention. So if she says anything foot and mouth, front and center.
Oh, yeah. No, there'll be memes and everything else. Yes.
Yeah, but it also means there's a lot of media attention that's going to be put on her no matter what. And that's the thing. It's going to
Right.
shift media attention to her as they scrutinize her, because if you don't put a lot of attention on her, you cannot scrutinize her.
Right.
And if she says something you like or says something you don't like, it's going to be up in front in the next 3 weeks. And you're going to know about it. So, this is that, opportunity for, voters to kind of see someone in their best and their not so best, how the media decides to review the situation.
Yeah, it did bring up a lot of questions about finances, about the money donated first to the Biden campaign and what happens to that.
Well, as I was telling my friends, I mean, there's a huge logistical practical issue here. And I'm hardly an expert on SEC law, right? I'm sorry, FEC, Federal Election Commission laws and campaign laws. I'm hardly an expert on state stuff, I know, but I don't know the federal stuff. I will say that, there are probably lawyers and accountants and political experts far better than I at the federal level who were doing enormous analysis and trying to figure out, what happens to campaign money because, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris' ticket is the campaign account. And if another nominee came out of the blue, that money cannot be just given to another candidate. Even though you can donate to the national committee, candidate money donated to a candidate stays with that candidate. And unless you start doing these weird backflips on a regulatory level, it would be extraordinarily difficult to try to move money around. It does not create an investigation by the Federal Election Commission about what you're really trying to do. There's also the campaign machine. I mean, we tend to be in a bubble up here, right? Massachusetts, let's be honest, is going to vote Democratic in the presidential primary. It has consistently since, actually consistently for a very long time. I'm trying to remember. I think maybe Reagan in 84, maybe,
Possibly, yeah.
possibly, has consistently said Democratic, maybe, but you have to look it up. But we don't feel the huge machine of a presidential campaign where you have a 1,000 volunteers, they're dropping $5 million in ads a week. You're getting inundated by mail and internet ads. You don't feel that in Massachusetts, that you're going to feel Wisconsin and Michigan and Arizona, Ohio,
Yeah,
Pennsylvania, New
the
Hampshire.
battleground states that they call here. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you my closest experience to that was the Martha Coakley, Scott Brown race. It was the first time that I got complaints from folks about the raw inundation of flyers, phone calls, and mailers in that time period from Christmas to the January. I can't remember what day it was, but it was, I think, the third week of January, that Tuesday for that Senate race. And people were really annoyed. Like, they were very upset. And the reason is because as much as we like to talk the big talk here about, politics, we've never had to really experience a statewide bombardment from like the whole country descending into one state on both political parties regarding that U.S. Senate seat, which Scott Brown did win. I did work on that campaign for Martha Coakley. And yeah, I was hearing it from people. It was just like, what is going on? I'm like, well, welcome to being in Florida. Welcome to being in Florida, right?
Yeah. Well, they're not going to waste their resources here, knowing what the outcome is going to be. I guess the closest thing we get to that is maybe the advocates for the ballot questions.
Maybe, but even then, it's not that severe. Like I said, the Coakley Scott Brown race that January, that 3 4 week time period, where literally all the resources from the RNC and the DNC came compounding in Massachusetts for that U.S. Senate seat, is probably the closest we have ever experienced in decades, many decades, regarding just like being inundated and frankly being annoyed and eventually upset by both political parties dropping all their resources into one place.
Yeah.
Because there was a special election in January. It wasn't like they were going anywhere else.
Well, that's right. That's all that was happening, right? So they could
Yeah.
afford to do that.
Yeah, both sides could afford to actually just crush us
Yeah.
with their money in
We
both
see it
parties.
sometimes when there's a New Hampshire Senate race because we get those ads down here too.
We do, but that's considered as part of a normal cycle,
Right.
right? In a special election cycle, they can always fundraise again to go back to normal cycles. But I mean, it was actually one of those things. I distinctly remember exactly how upset people really got. And I was like, oh, welcome to Florida. It's one thing to talk about being a battleground state. Oh, why don't anyone pay attention to us? Because we're not a battleground state. And when we finally experienced it, wow, that was how long? That was almost 15 years
Yeah.
now, closing in on 15 years. So I mean, oh, we've 14 years, January, 2010. Yeah, it was oh, we should be a battleground state. We should he should be important until that. Like, if you remember that through the period, before the period when you had the full experience of a background, say, I've never heard anyone complain. Well, immediately after that, no one complained about that again.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah, and it was all perfectly legal.
that was it. I'm like, well, you wanted experience. You like that experience? You know, go back to that 4 week period back in 2010 January.
Right,
So,
exactly.
but we'll see how it plays out. I mean, obviously, there's all kinds of pundits talking about the vice presidential candidate that Kamala Harris will have to pick at some point to the ticket. They are going to go for the virtual roll call. At the end of this month into early next month, prior to the DNC, because they feel they've already locked down all the votes they need. She's over 50%, but I suspect be much more than just 50%. So, you know, what initially was I heard was not going to happen is going to happen. This is virtual roll call in the last few days in July into the first few days of August to lock down those delegate votes before actually going to the convention. In the process, so we should have a VP selection by the end of this roll call. And you know, unlike conventional convention time periods, you know, you unveil the vice presidential candidate at the convention. So again, this is going to break a lot of historical trends of how things are done. Just because historically done doesn't mean it always has to be done. And you know, and I don't have a I'm not going to sit here and give you my odds on favorites regarding who the candidate could be, but it's I think this is going to be very interesting how it's going to play.
Well, it's going to be a pick from one of those battleground states, obviously.
Yeah, I agree with that, but it's not just a battleground state. My personal opinion, it's a regional issue. So you're looking to find someone that can appeal to obviously not just the state they're from, but also a broader demographic beyond that. And the profile, the ability to campaign, the ability to fundraise, the ability to be a team player on the ticket, the ability to help message, the ability you don't have to supervise them. They can go surrogate for you around the country. Worry about them being something saying something. I won't name names, but if you are observer of political campaigns, this has happened before where your VP just starts talking about stuff that's off message. And that's hurt a lot of presidential races. So it's a lot of factors involved, right? It's not just simply a battleground state, it's a battleground great state plus, you know, regional and wider appeal.
Interesting. All right, stay tuned. We'll be talking about this, I'm sure, in the weeks to come.
Oh, I mean, it's great political conversation for us in this gig. And you know, I could sit here and speculate and give you my predictions, but can't promise you to be correct. So I think it's best we just hold off on some of my opinions until we actually have a definitive answer.
Does it cause this poor Secretary of State here in Massachusetts to have to redo all the ballots?
You know, I had a friend text me about that because there's some fake news, big surprise, going on in the ballots. You are indeed receiving your primary ballot for September 3rd. If you did a mail-in ballot, they've already gone out. So you have received that. You will notice there is no presidential candidates on your primary ballot.
No, we already had that in March.
Correct. And this is the fake news I got from my friends that, oh, the ballots are screwed up. You're gonna see, you know, President Biden on the ballot because, you know, the ballots have gone out for the September primary, but the primary, right, it was done in March. So there is no ballot printing because ballots don't get printed until after the DNC convention. And, you know, realistically speaking, you can't print ballots until the Democratic and Republican primaries for state senator, state rep, and the county positions are over with on September 3rd.
Gotcha. Makes perfect sense. How do you know for sure? You can guess,
Yeah.
but you won't know.
Oh, this thing's already moving. I got a call from a friend who was very confused and had explained the whole DNC selection process, which in itself is actually very confusing, to be honest with you.
It's
It's
true.
a type of electoral college when you come right down to it. But it's, you know, after trying to get past that explanation, they had to explain the whole ballot printing process. And like I said, you cannot print ballots until you complete the primary process in Massachusetts, meaning, you know, September 3rd. Some states I'm aware that they have different dates for primaries. So, you know, some have them in the summertime, some have them earlier in the year. But regardless, the printing of ballots do not go out until the month of October in terms of heading to the printer. Well, actually late September, because this September 3rd is it's early
So
possible.
early this year, yeah.
Yeah, it's the earliest possible thing, which means they're going to go to the printer essentially the second week of September, which means they'll be ready by the first day of October, which means that if you have a mail-in ballot, you're gonna get your ballot, the 3 or so weeks beforehand. So I mean, folks, be cautious of fake news. What sounds like common sense is not common sense. And this is the fear I have regarding fake information. First instinct, oh, that's common sense. No, it's not. It's illogical. It can't be common sense if it's illogical.
That's true. Did people already forget that they voted in March and Biden won in Massachusetts?
Well, that's exactly it. Trump won, Biden won. I mean, but it doesn't mean that the ballots, can't change, or the ballots can't change. Ballots aren't even printed, much less
Right,
change.
right.
They're not even printed now. If Joe Biden dropped out in February when the printed ballots have been printed, now that's total chaos and it results in a write-in campaign.
That's right. Yep.
So somebody may not remember, Joe Biden, for whatever reason, their campaign did not put themselves on the ballot in New Hampshire.
I remember, yes.
And New Hampshire's first primary in the country. And as a
Yes.
result, scores of Democrats from around the country, including Massachusetts, found themselves in New Hampshire in a February, January, February, to get people to write in Joe Biden's name. And he did win on a write-in campaign. So, I mean,
I
that's.
remember it was a snub to the state convention because they didn't endorse him.
Yeah, it was a whole thing, right? So. And also, Democrat primary, first primary in the nation had moved to South Carolina, from a DNC standpoint. But state law in New Hampshire says they have to go first because their law there says that they will always be before what the first primary in the country.
Right,
So,
so they did it anyway, yeah.
yeah, welcome to the conflict between state parties, national parties, and state laws and
Right.
states control elections, right? So, yeah, I mean. If there's a scenario, let's say something awful happens and a candidate literally drops dead before the after ballots are printed and you get to the final election, and let's say one of the candidates literally dropped dead in a tragic situation, you have to do a write-in campaign
Yep.
because there's nothing else you can do.
Right.
And that's where it gets, difficult. And again, back to the Secret Service. It is absolutely essential that we get to the bottom line. Down in Congress anyway, the DC guys need to get bottom line to prevent this from ever happening.
Absolutely. Yep. Boy, oh boy, some historic occurrences here, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'll be curious how the pundits write this up in the history books, 5 years down the road. I mean, the history books will get updated, and there'll be all kinds of scholars doing analysis stuff on this. Regarding what it means, because we don't even feel the impact for a few years based on any decision made at that particularly at that level. But also it'll be a study in how campaigning works, and campaigning has changed because one of the things is that the Republican Party is now pivoting their messaging, and obviously they could going after her record as part of the Biden administration, so that's kind of open game, right? That's pretty easy. And then to go after her Senate record, which is only a short period of time, 4 years. And then that leaves her attorney general record in California. And we'll see how they frame those issues beyond any kind of personal attacks. And then there's also the problem of the debate. The second debate in September was negotiated between the Biden folks and the Trump folks, not the Harris folks.
Right.
So will we have a debate? And that is actually an interesting question because both campaigns snubbed the media, who, and was it the, what is that called? The debate association group that's composed of the biggest news media.
Oh, yeah, I can't think of it either, but I know what you mean.
They both parties snubbed them. So I don't know how this is going to play out in the fall because presidential debate is where voters get a chance to see the differentiation between the two groups. It gives more political pundits the ability to analyze on behalf of the public multiple points of view on the matter, and also gives fodder for both political parties to kick the crap out of each other.
Right. Plus, there was no audience, as you recall, in the first debate, so that changes the dynamic too.
Yeah, I actually thought that no audience was an advantage to Joe Biden,
I
that he did
agree. Yeah.
quite horrifically on. Audiences can be really distracting, particularly if noise. And it's like being at a golf tournament, right? You know, professional golf, you can't make noise. And I think that's a big part of it. So the fact that Joe Biden did so horrifically, what I personally thought worked to his advantage, you know, added to the whole, we got to do something about this. Not me personally, you know, the big we on this matter. So again, I wait, stay tuned. I mean, it'd be very interesting how it does it. If I'm the Harris camp, I want debates. I want three debates if I'm the Harris camp. From the Trump camp, I think it's a little bit harder because the calculations really shifted. And, you know, this isn't Hillary Clinton. This isn't Joe Biden. This is, you know, a third candidate that he is running against. You know, you know, Donald Trump is running against a third person that's totally different from the first two.
For sure. Can we bring it back to the state for a minute, Tacky, and talk about a bill to help control prescription drug costs?
Yeah, this is something I never realized. I have this fun fact sheet in front of me about pharmacy benefit managers, PMDs, and what is it? Pharmaceutical manufacturers, PMCs. I did not know this. Well, when we love to big up, we love to pick on big pharma. It's a great political fighter, right? Nobody likes big pharma. I didn't realize the drug pricing we all pay for is actually run by these PMBs, PMCs, the pharmacy benefit managers and the pharmaceutical manufacturing companies. And these are the in-betweens between the pharma companies and the pharmacies. So this is like a middleman between the two. They're the ones that actually sets the price structures and negotiation. I put in quotations, those who use air quotes, you know, between the pharma and the pharmacies. Now, pharma can't move a drug to a pharmacy without its PMB. And then conversely, the pharma company, the pharmacy can't get the drugs from the pharma while going through these PMBs and PMCs. And they're the ones who set that price structure.
It's
And
like
we,
agents. It's like representing both sides.
well, it turns out that there's been a consolidation in this industry to the point where, according to the Joint Committee on Healthcare Finance, I'm trying to remember the statistic correctly, I believe four companies control 80% of the market, six companies control 90% of the market. One of the biggest ones that you may be aware, not aware of, is CVS Caremark. And they've become a vertical monopoly, CVS Caremark, because they control the price structure that actually benefits CVS but screw over Walgreens. So, and since there's such a limited choices and all of them behave poorly and all of them behave with the same price structure, if you try to fight as a pharmacy, whether it be Walgreens or a small independent family pharmacy, you get basically blackballed. You will be blacklisted. You will be completely shut out by the other companies. And
Really?
yeah, and now you're really trapped with this PMB or PMC to provide the price structure, which then is passed along to you. And these guys will basically muscle insurance companies or insurance reimbursements. They actually will decide on what drugs you can get regarding what is available. As much as we talk about, you know, insulin, for example, has astronomical costs. It's not entirely on the pharma company. You know, these guys will add on to the bottom line, and pharma can't move out their drugs without these guys. So they dictate the price against pharma. Oh, this thing is horrific when I finally learned about it. There's a New York Times article here, which I will reach over my desk from, June 21st, 2004, titled "The OPEC Industry Secretly Inflating Prices for Prescription Drugs." If you have a New York Times subscription, well, actually, this one was actually, I think, I got on open source. I don't think they fire out paywall this, but the OPEC industry secretly inflating prices for prescription drugs in the New York Times. Definitely give it a read. It is actually a very confusing article because of so many parts, but it's frightening. So what did we do? We created more transparency. We created a licensing structure. We moved the pharmacy industry into a different licensing mechanism. We put them as part of the healthcare a policy commission. We you know, put them into CHEA, our Center of Health and Information Analysis. We do a whole lot of daylighting on the state level to find out what is going on. We require consumer sale disclosures, price disclosures, require pharmacies to, do the proper estimates and the rebates to consumers. We put in some maximum allowances. We put fees and surcharges of 10%. We started capping fees and surcharges. We increased the penalties to $25,000 per license. I'm sorry, the fee is $25,000. And then we require a division of insurance to do audits every 3 years of these groups. We really crack down on this stuff. And one of the big ones is reading off the sheet. It requires insurance carriers to identify one generic drug, one brand name drug to treat each of the following conditions: diabetes, asthma, and the most prevailing heart conditions among enrollees. Identify generic drugs as covered without cost sharing and identify benefit brands, capped at $24 per 30-day supply. Those are the three, one of the three, those three drugs are the most highly consumed drugs for diabetes, asthma, and heart conditions. And that's where that price structure actually, killing folks at those local level. And, I hate to say it, but, even myself and you at some point are going to need more medication as we age. As we know, as we get older, our income gets more fixed, and you're just actually crushing the senior population on these prices. The hope is that, the Senate adopts this, because it only passed the House this week. The Senate has not adopted this. And, we start really holding some accountability with these invisible third-party intermediaries that none of us knew existed. As you can tell, I really don't like these guys.
Yeah, I can tell.
Is that apparent enough? But I'm hoping, and we're all hoping in the House, that the Senate takes up this bill before the close of session. But if they don't, we're coming back again.
I know it's a priority of the speaker for sure.
I started learning about this about 4 months ago, and the more I started learning about it, the more I'm like, oh, we got to do something with these folks.
Right.
And I went to healthcare finance, to committee. I'm like, hey guys, you guys are doing something? And their response was, yes, don't ask. We are working on it. Don't ask again. We're going to address it. So, I was that upset. I made an inquiry over the committee. Like, don't need to ask twice. We are working on it. Pass about a week. And healthcare stuff takes up to 5 years to see the maturation of our results. Same thing of energy. I think, those two particular topics, when we do major reforms, it takes about 5 years to see, what is the note of benefit to the public. And it takes a little bit of time for it to evolve. And so that, windmills are going up, right? We voted for windmills quite a long time ago, actually, and also some subsequent bills regarding renewable generation. But I mean, they're finally making their way up, despite, one of the blades having a fiberglass problem.
Was just going to say there was a little bit of an issue with one of them. And I think it was just high winds that caused damage. I read somewhere it was a manufacturing defect in that particular blade.
It happens. I'm sorry. It does. I mean, there is a manufacturing error. They'll stress test these things heavily. Engineers will review it. They have all kinds of equipment. But, these things will happen, and hopefully it won't be anymore. But, manufacturing errors do happen, and, thankfully it's something that can be addressed, at this part of the process, as opposed to when they're up. But it is true, you can destroy a windmill if the winds are high enough.
Apparently, yeah,
It's not difficult to figure it out why, but this one was a manufacturing issue. It wasn't like a category two hurricane.
right, exactly, yeah, which I'm sure they're engineered to withstand because they're out in the middle of the ocean.
Oh yeah, but if you go to like center part of the country, but there actually is a lot of wind farms in open space, all it takes is one tornado and kind of goes through a farm. Tornadoes like flat spaces. So
Yeah, I don't know that there's much you can do to withstand a tornado if it's intense enough. Yeah.
yeah, that's one of the challenges of land-based wind farms, because they build a lot of them in their flat space with prevailing winds, and then a tornado goes by. Or even if it's not a tornado, the winds could exceed cl close to tornado strength, and then if they don't lock the blades down correctly, they'll spin off it. That's why you don't see big wind farms near giant population centers
Right.
because the windmills, not just one, could just complete, you know, things flying through the air. And it can't happen. It can't happen. So, but you know, but on the flip side, you all do know now windmills are indeed going up. The
Oh,
offshore.
yes, if there was any doubt. Yeah. There's more slated in the pipeline too.
Yeah, you know, it's a major part of our renewable energy portfolio. You know, obviously, by 2050, you know, the goal is to get to you know, near all renewable power in some format. You know, part of the Senate bill, the House bill's discussion about tapping out of basic Canadian, for lack of basic Canadian nuclear power, because Canada is nuclear, they're going nuclear. So, you know, they're going to overgenerate on purpose because they want to sell to the US. And
True.
that's what. So, you know, we want to be in that pipeline of, you know, all types of no emissions energy sources that are available in the energy region. And one of the things the Senate, I'm sorry, one of the things the House did, you know, I talked about this last time, was streamline the siting process of energy. Energy includes battery. Siting because battery, long-term battery storage is still the key, and battery technology is moving along. I still think it's very challenging in cold weather climates and batteries, but it's a day-by-day process, and there'll be more upgrades to battery technology, and we want to be ready on our siting process once it reaches that stage. A lot of stuff is built in anticipation of new renewable construction, but also a storage construction, and the batteries, you know, the size of warehouses, not. They're not small, but it's still an energy siting factor. So, you know, a lot of stuff with getting ready, things we need to do it. And yeah, I wish I had a way to put it other than that, but yeah, we're just trying to get ready.
Yeah, what's well, I mean, yeah, it seems like the logical way to go as opposed to the whole EV industry, which put the cars first and then decided to look at the charging stations.
Yeah, EVs continue to always be a chicken and egg problem. Because if you build a bunch of EV stations and nobody uses it, then we have a problem
Right.
because infrastructure has been put in place, private to run by private companies. Private companies are going to bleed money, and how long can they wait on the bleed? And then you do have to do a massive electrical upgrade because you're going to draw more power, which means you have to get more power from somewhere else. I mean, some estimates put, you know, between 5 and 10% new stress on the grid nationally if you do, you know, too many EVs. Put aside the cost of the cars. You know, on the second side, yeah, you want to have lower emissions, no emissions, and you know, EVs in particular will do that for you. And you don't want mileage anxiety. And this is a real economics I think people don't seem to want to accept, is that you can have a lot of EVs. But the EVs don't move at the pace of strategically placed, and it's very important, strategically placed charging stations and sufficient volume of charging stations. The car manufacturers do not lose money, but
Right.
people look at charging station publicly traded stocks, they're very challenged public companies. And I don't know how the private companies do because there's no public information, private companies. But if you look at public companies, electrical charging stations, you know, it's extremely challenged. Because an unused charging station loses money.
Sure, it's like an open store that nobody goes to. Yeah.
That's why charging stations tend to follow the basic car registrations. If your registrations are high in a very specific community, charging stations want to go there. They're not very high in the community, they're not going to go there. So, I mean, I'm sure people are listening, oh, we should put charging stations everywhere and it creates more EV users. I'm like, no, I mean, you know, it's a practical issue regarding cars. If you are listening to you know, a middle-income family, you're willing to change your car over, you know, a lot regularly. I mean, good for you. I intend to keep my car until I run it into the ground. I have no debt on my car. 5 years of loan payments are gone, and yeah, my car is going to get run to the ground before I get another one from
That's right. Exactly.
And then, you know, we'll probably go to EV too, or maybe a hybrid. That's still years down the road. I try to make sure my car is good shape. But yeah, I mean, most people will run their cars into the ground before they make the change, and the price structures will change. So, I mean, it's the argument for EVs really is more complex. People oversimplify this thing, and people have no sensitivity to EV charging station economics. They like just don't care. The company will go out of business if it makes no money. It ain't complicated, people.
Right.
But the reason this part of the argument is like lost on folks, right? And you know, that's why EV charging stations are always looking for government subsidies, which frankly is impractical at a certain point. You know, it's putting money into a pit, just throwing government money into a pit. And then they want like private businesses to build an electrical infrastructure. Well, what's their incentive on private property? Yeah, exactly. The charging station has to pay that private property owner. I mean,
Yeah,
what?
you can't put out more money than you're taking in. It's not gonna, the math doesn't work.
That's correct. So I mean, it's not more EVs. Does not mean more charging stations. More charging stations doesn't mean more EVs. Gas stations move from horse and buggy sites to become gas stations. A lot of horse and buggy sites were, gas stations were once horse and buggy sites at one time. And then, gas stations popped up around car mileage. Cars were doing like 15 miles a gallon. You need more gas stations. And I don't know if you all noticed, but as mileage has creeped to the 25, 30, 40, 50 miles per gallon, we actually have less gas stations density,
Interesting.
right? Because you don't have to fill up as often, which also changes the economics of gas stations because, those who are old enough don't remember them ever selling candy bars.
That's true.
And there was no self-serve. Gas
It's
stations
also true. Yeah.
always full serve. Self-serve was like a novelty at
Right.
what that caught on because it was saving money for the gas station because your car was not filling up as often.
Yeah, so you didn't have to pay an attendant to be there.
That's correct. And it costs, became more expensive for the gas station. So they had a over time that you don't notice, well, somebody maybe not be old enough, but those who are young, you don't realize that what you have with how you do gas stations is vastly different. Once car mileage efficiency competition, because that's essentially what happened, the car industry started competing to get more efficiency out of each car. It really changed the gas industry.
Yeah, it's just the natural evolution of advancement.
And it's only going to get more efficient.
Yeah.
Cars that are using combustion engines will not get less efficient. Maybe you buy like even if no, that's not true. I mean, even if you buy like a sports car, like an eight cylinder muscle car, trust me, that thing is considerably more efficient than its predecessors.
No, sure. Yeah, just by the nature of technology, yeah.
Yeah, and the expectation is that they're gonna create even more efficiency on combustion engines. At the same time, EVs are going to get more efficient, and hybrids are not going away either. So, you got all these different vehicles, but the economics, like I said, economics of EVs, the economics of charging stations is very involved. As you guys can tell, I've looked at this before.
Speaking of traveling, we have to travel on out of here, Tacky. We're out of time.
We are how quickly we move at the Statos, huh? I know. I made a joke there. You guys,
Bump, bump.
a bit of bump, yes. Well, I'm in room 42 today, so you know where I am. Oh, actually, no, I have one more event to talk about. Since you like to talk about events, I'm actually going to Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is coming to Boston.
Oh.
Yeah, she's doing a fundraiser for her PAC at the UMass Club. So I am actually coming into town tomorrow specifically to attend the event and listen in on what's going on. Actually, this is my first federal thing on a national level I've ever been at. I've obviously done some local stuff. But I've never, ever, ever gone to any kind of like presidential campaign-ish. Again, this is not a battleground state. And I've never actually gone to like any kind of fundraising things. One, I'm too poor, so it's not like I have a lot of money. So there was a lot of complimentaries going on for this fundraiser for electeds. But I'm very interested to listen in on what's going on there. And I made a modest donation to this event. And I'm actually very interested in Governor Gretchen Whitmer. She's quite impressive. And she's tough. What's it? Well, my favorite image was a backyard with a hunting rifle. I was like, yep, she's a shooter. Don't mess with her. She also has to make a lot of hard decisions in a tough state with a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
Michigan is a lot of things in Michigan that's very challenging, and the governor has a very hard job over there. So, and there's also another background state like Wisconsin. So that's kind of my part of things I'm doing this week.
Neat.
Yeah, room 42. I'm here. This evidence I do show up at work. 617-722-2370. 617-722-2370 is the phone number. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. During this call, I've been just constantly watching email pops up on my right-hand corner from Microsoft Outlook. We do have social media. We have State Representative Tacky Chan on Facebook. We do have at Tacky Chan. We do have TackyChan.org for our informational page. We do have MALegislature.gov. So if you want to watch us in the closing days, we are on the internet. And of course, we're here with Joe every week or 2 weeks discussing things that just come to mind. And if you know, again, if you guys want to talk about a topic, I'll email Joe because it's his show, not mine. And we'll see what we can do.
Sounds good. Thanks, Techie.
Well, good to see you, Joe. Catch you here. I'm going to be here in the office next week as we try to close out the final days.
Right, we'll talk to you then.